Hello, Food Chain. This is Sharon Chitone, and I'm a food tech junkie and innovation nerd who loves a good story. This podcast combines all of my favorite vices into a deep dive about the problems our food system faces and the visionary people working on solutions. Join us in this episode as we dive into the world of agri-food tech in Europe with Nargis Çakır, the dynamic leader behind EIT's Rising Food Stars program. As an advocate for transformative change in the agri-food industry, Nargis is on a mission to create an inclusive future of food. During our conversation, we'll delve into the challenges and opportunities within the sector, explore the importance of collaboration and scaling impact, and uncover the role of innovation in driving meaningful change. Get ready to be inspired as we tap into Nargis's wealth of knowledge and gain valuable insights into the incredible potential for innovation and growth in the European agri-food industry. So without any further ado, let's welcome Nargis. Hey Nargis, how are you?
Hey Sharon, so good to see you. How are you?
I am good. I am happy to have you on today and to learn about the incredible work that you are doing and to learn more about your take on what's happening in the food innovation space. But can you tell us a little bit, before we dive into all of that, how you got started and what led you to do what you're doing today?
Yeah, thank you, Sharon. I'm super excited to be here today. Thanks for having me. So for everyone there, Nargis, a lot of people struggle to pronounce my name, so that's why I'm like better to clarify it. I'm originally Moroccan, but I consider myself a citizen of the world as I lived in so many countries on top of Morocco. I lived in France, Spain, a bit in Japan, actually, Dubai, and recently in Belgium. And I'm married to a Mexican. So yeah, you can tell that I love this aspect of my life. I'm an engineer by training. But I switched early on in my career to work in marketing because I really like the 360 approach of looking at the business. I think it's not anymore the traditional marketing where we talk communication is about brand management and managing your business as a really the CEO of your brand. I found this part super exciting. Most of my professional experience has been with companies in the food industry, mainly American companies, multinationals, where I had roles in innovation, marketing, brand management. And I must admit that my favorite part was the roles that I had in product development and innovation. I really loved the collaboration with the insights team to generate insights with consumers, being close to them, going to their places, working with R&D in the labs, but also with the commercial teams to bring to life something really concrete that makes sense for the consumer, the shopper, the distributor. So it was a quite exciting time. But I felt at a certain point that corporation was still missing on this disruptiveness when it comes to innovation. And you end up launching kind of the type of innovations that are low risk, with the high return on the short term, focusing on operational efficiency. So ended up most of the time being new flavors, new sizes, resizing, new packaging. And I think I wanted to see something different. I wanted to really see if it was different in other industries or if it was happening differently in the startup world. And that's what took me to take a kind of break in my early 30s to do MBA in ESA. And my focus was really on learning more about innovation and entrepreneurship. It was a great opportunity actually to have a lot of exposure there. Ended up doing some work for big tech companies and going to some conferences. And actually, this is how, you know, things started unfolding by being the right place at the right moment, actually in one of the conferences called Doing Good, Doing Well, that is held by your ESA on a yearly basis to bring in the whole sense of impact across different industries. I was preparing for one of the panel around the future of the food industry, and I met Ryan, the CEO of Naked Innovations. And we were really clicked. And after going back from my experience within tech, I said, oh, actually, combining food and tech could be really a good place to be for me, you know, with my experience, with all what I've seen in my MBA. So I started the working together with Ryan on some projects related to innovation in the agri-food industry. And from there, I actually discovered the IT Food. I didn't hear about it before, which was quite surprising, which is the European Institute for Innovation and Technology, and worked actually with them as a consultant initially on a few projects. And then there was a role that opened afterwards and decided to join because it was really a good fit with what I wanted to see as a continuity for my professional development. And it was actually a natural move because scale-ups are basically more closer to the experience that I had, where we can do more work about go-to-market, customer acquisition. And also for me, for my own learning and development, it was the right space to be really at the heart of the most interesting innovations in the agri and food spaces.
Yeah, and the rest is history.
Exactly.
I guess if you think about it, between your previous experience and now working for, I mean, a large institution, but also working with so many teams, it's very multidisciplinary. That gives you that system-wide view that prompts you to look at everybody's perspective. I believe it's helpful. What about you?
Yeah, for sure. I think I always joke about the fact that when you're having this type of roles in multinationals, you're not expert in anything. The reality is that you're bringing together all the experts and helping them to work together, putting the framework, putting the targets, the deadline, managing the project. But it's quite fascinating because we need people who are bringing people together to work, right, in such complex matrix of multinationals. And actually, I see it even more now with the IT Food. The challenge is really how to get, there are so many experts out there with the brilliant knowledge, brilliant skills that I would never have personally. But yeah, the challenge is always to bring them to work together in an efficient way and learn from them. I mean, you have the R&D, you have the supply chain, you have the trade marketing working with you, the quality and regulation team, you have the consumer insights, the data part of the whole picture. So I think that is the beauty and was the beauty of this job that I was having. And I think at a different level now with the IT Food is a kind of the similar school.
Yeah. And what exactly do you do for IT Food?
So I joined IT Food a little bit more than, let's say, a year and a half now, towards end of 2021. And I'm part of what we call actually business creation or entrepreneurship programs. We have three programs supporting startups in different stages. The first one is called Seedbed. That is our incubator for basically either a small team that just started or tech founder that is looking to validate his idea in the market. Then we have what we call the Food Accelerator Network. That is our accelerator. And the aim of it is to validate the technology and start developing, these startups to be ready to get into commercialization. And I personally lead the third program called Rising Food Stars. That is our accelerators for scale-ups, where we help startups that are really at the age of becoming scale-ups. So we call them early stage scale-ups, to upscale their commercial capabilities. So we're very much focused on this aspect of, bringing commercial capabilities to life, which include different aspects here. So from the org to the culture, to the operations, to revisiting your mission and vision, right? When you're scaling up, it's different. Just scale up is not a startup, as we like to say. And then we work with different departments also at IT Food. We have innovation, education, and public engagement. So we collaborate together to bring various offerings to the startup in our program. And if I had to sum up this offerings is helping them to access funding. So how to connect them with the investors, understand also the investment landscape, what makes sense for them, etc. My personal take on this is that my mission as a program lead is to empower the startups to also understand how to cooperate and choose beyond the, you know, the side of deciding and choosing by choosing the right time to start the investment, choosing the investors that align with their values, etc. So that's this part related to the investment landscape preparation. We help them also to collaborate with corporates. Mm-hmm. So that part about corporate venturing services. I think there is an important piece here about startups not knowing the world of corporate, not knowing how to speak to them, how to tailor their value proposition. So I do a lot of work with the startups as well in this area. And then we have an important part, especially for scale-up stage, that is about visibility, PR. So we support them by inviting them to the biggest events across Europe, being featured in articles, videos, podcasts. So we play this role of connector and also within our EIT food platforms.
There's a lot to unpack there, definitely. Let's talk about that. You mentioned two very important things, investments and corporations. And many startups often need both to pilot solutions, validate and scale, and on the other hand, find, gain that financial stability to help them grow. In the past years, before COVID, we've lived inside a kind of bubble where investments and evaluations were crazy high. And now, obviously, there's a stall. What are, in your opinion, the main differences between Europe and the rest of the world, mainly other hubs like the US, Singapore, or Israel, for example, on the investment side?
Yeah, that's a very important question. And actually, it's part of also the education we want to bring to our startups to make them aware of what's happening on the investment side and why we're seeing this slowdown and how to relook at their valuations. And you're right, like, I think there are some corrections happening in terms of valuations that we have been seeing since last year. It will continue this year. We've seen that the cycles are also way longer to fundraise. So you really have to anticipate. We're talking about 6 to 9 months. I think I've seen now more 9 to 18 months. So you really have to be careful about your runway, etc. And you're absolutely right. I think in 2022, we received recently the reports on the industry. We've seen a decline of 40% in terms of investment in the agri-food, which is quite massive. If you think about it, it's like dividing by two. So imagine about the number of deals, number of startups that would survive. And if we had to compare Europe to especially North America and Asia, I think we're still here in the third position, knowing that, Europe with all its history, with so many countries, so many universities, research centers, we're still number three. US is, I think North America is around 14, 15 billion. Asia captures maybe around 8 billion euros in terms of investment, and Europe is around 5. And what I found fascinating actually in the last reports is that the whole Europe, and you imagine, Sharon, is the size of California. So 5 billion investment for agri-food, that's a comparison just for agri-food. So it's quite interesting, right? If you look at it from this angle, how can such a big continent be the size of one state, right?
Yeah.
And I think somehow when you look at the risk, we all know about the mindset, the approach to risk. I think there's the whole dynamic of regulation policy. Expansion in Europe is also quite hard, you know, because the regions are so different. The regulations are also so different from one part to another. The cultures, I mean, if you think about it, southern compared to the Nordics is completely different, which doesn't give the startup also the scale potential that they might get from the US or Asia. And I think what I've seen recently is that a lot of countries in Europe, by their own initiative, they started having programs funded by their own governments to support startups to go to the US and in the agri-food industry. So that's quite interesting because they realize if they want to increase the number of unicorns coming from their countries, that's the only way to go. If they want to go faster, attract the right investment, the right support, coaching, et cetera, that's the right place to be. So I think that's very interesting shift that we're seeing in the past few years, be it with Netherlands, Germany. There are so many initiatives that I see the startups in my program going to expand to the US. I think also what is interesting in Europe is that you have different dynamics, and Europe is very difficult to think about as one unit, right?
Yes.
Most of the innovation, I think more than 70 or 80, would be coming from 5 countries, mm-hmm. France, Germany, UK, I think Norway and Netherlands would be the top 5. Sweden somehow should be there. For us as EIT Food, we came up with some initiative, I think at EIT level, with some programs like the regional innovation schemes that aim to support regions, southern and eastern region, to drive innovation, create more startups, help them to scale faster. But I think we're still quite lagging behind even more in this region if we think about it.
Yes, absolutely. I think policy plays a huge role. More than that, I think is key. Take any regulatory processes that has been validated in one place, but it's still way behind in others. For example, cultivated meat. And in Europe, not only we are behind, but we have a member state, Italy, completely against and doing like crazy fake campaigns. And I think it's pretty much against sort of that progress. So I think we focus so much in talking about innovation and not talking enough about policy. One cannot exist without the other. But let's go back to investments. I think that, it's better today to have reason instead of exaggeration. Giving hundreds of millions of dollars to a relatively early stage company in a way is a setback. It's like giving a Porsche to a teenager. I believe that there needs to be an organic growth instead of, you know, have so much and then always have to be on top. When you fall, then it's a bigger fall, right? But instead, if you do things slowly and organically, I think you grow more. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think it's explained so many times to the startup that is not necessarily in their interest to have high valuations, even go for high rounds of investments early on. Because then it's actually, I think there are some statistics that shows that it sets them for failure, right? Because nobody's gonna take them in the next round. That's the difficult part of it. And you're absolutely right. We've seen some investments going on in seed or series A that were in the range of 100 million euros. And this is absolutely not the type of tickets for this size of enterprises as we define them. I think especially in the area of the alternative proteins, there was a lot of hype that got investors excited and a bit dreamy, but the picture is changing now. I think the reality is that these companies first need to prove themselves in terms of commercial traction, in terms of profitability, scalability, efficiency, even impact in some cases, right? Sustainability is not always granted. Speaking now about the cellular agriculture, there are a lot of questions around it, right? If you scale up, then how about the energy? How about, you know, the impact that you're having on the environment? Is it really the size of what was promised when you scale up? So I think yeah, definitely this correction had to happen. And we're trying to bring awareness to our startups about it. I run an investor series every couple of months where we'll bring in different perspective from investors to hear about what's going on and also have their take on the reality so that the startups are not in their, what I call Lana Land, right? So they come back to reality and know how to talk with the investors and be better prepared when they're having this conversation on valuations, because I think if you start from the wrong foot, it would never lead you anywhere in the conversation with the investors by just throwing a crazy number that is not anymore, in line with the expectations of the market.
Totally agree. Yes. Let's go back to what I mentioned before. What are the regulatory processes, those policy issues that you see in Europe that maybe you don't see in other countries and that are making Europe a little bit slower in adapting with innovation?
Yeah. I think for me, Sharon, we have to step back sometimes when we're talking about regulation and policy, because we always think about it in a negative way somehow as being in the world of innovation and startups. And for me, it was very interesting to attend some last panels recently and the events I went to where it came to remind me that actually this is done for, better protecting as consumers and citizens in Europe. It's about our safety. It's about our avoiding certain massive health, the environmental issues, etc. But at the same time, I totally agree with you. I think the processes here in Europe are quite lengthy. There are a lot of lack of clarity. There is also lack of knowledge from the side of startups on where to go, to whom to talk. They're not having specifically this kind of skills in their teams. And it's very costly as well to hire the right experts. So there is a big barrier here. And I think what I've seen even more challenging in the case of scale-ups is that when you're scaling up, sometimes you have to question or change a little bit the process, the ingredients, the components of your product or service. So in order to go again and apply, you have to reapply again. So you lose all the time that you did in the first phase and you have to go and reapply again, which makes the process even more complex, even more lengthy at all the stages of the startup, right? So for me personally, as a Rising Food Stars manager, this is an area that I'm trying to work on a lot to empower the scale-ups in my program by giving them the right guidance and tools to navigate the system, because it's a very complex system that's admitted. And I've seen companies that took them 3 years or more in order to get approvals. I have seen companies that might go bankrupt because now with the reality of the investors asking for these companies to get commercial traction before they can invest, then how do you continue surviving as a startup, right? If the regulation is going against me, then what do I do? But I think also this is the entrepreneurial spirit, right? If you're in a place where you feel like regulation is slow, is not giving you the right speed, it's up to you to move and look for other alternative. And that's why, again, a lot of the startups decide sometimes to go to the US or to Asia to get some commercial traction there and eventually come back to Europe. So I think there are ways around it, smart ways to at least get started while your approval is going on in Europe that might take years before materializing or never materialized, right?
Yeah.
Like the example you gave in Italy about cylinder art, I think is quite disappointing for the startup. So better to start preparing for these alternatives. Some smart companies that I have in my program are already preparing the ground to go to the US, mostly exploring also the Asian markets to not be in this situation.
Yes, totally agree. And I mean, this is one challenge. What are some of the other challenges that you see happening for startups that are trying to scale? And what kind of support is out there for them?
Yeah. I think overall for startups, there is a big, big challenge on differentiation. I would say that's the first part. First, differentiation versus established companies versus other startups. There is a crazy amount of competition, which, I mean, if you think about it, it's really good. We see almost 50,000 new startups created every year in Europe, among them maybe around 2,500, 3,000, assumptions around the agri-food, the ones that are created in the agri-food. So you're competed with a lot, and even in the same field, like this year in the application for the Rising Food Stars, we saw so many applications around precision farming. And I think what makes a difference is the startups that are really good about their value proposition and also very honest about what they're doing to differentiate themselves for the earlier stage ones, right? I think the other issue for all startups at different stages is the high risk, right? They operate in an environment of uncertainty, a lot of ambiguity, a lot of market volatility. Technology is also advancing, the knowledge is advancing. So I think making the right decision in this type of environment and with so many less resources than would have a great companies is quite challenging. And that's why we see a low survival rate at the different stages between the start, like from ideation, let's say incubation to becoming an established startup, I think only 10% make it. And again, from an established startup to becoming a scale up, around 5% only make it. And I think for us, the role managing such type of programs, be it incubators, accelerators, scale up support, our primary objective and all the people I work with in the ecosystem is how can we increase the survival rate by giving them the right tools at the right moment to make the right decisions. Sometimes it's just access to data, access to the right expert at the right time, right funding also. So that's quite interesting. If we speak about the case of scale-up in particular, I think that the most challenging part is acquiring new customers, right? And convincing them. Because it might be easy to get your first pilot. Someone got excited, got interested, maybe you get the second one. But then how do you move from having two or three customers to having kind of systemic customer acquisition that is more strategic, that you are super clear on who is your target customers and how do you have a whole go-to-markets that go with it? I think that's something we work a lot with our startups, especially in the Rising Food Stars program, to understand how to do this shift, because it requires a mindset shift. You have to be super clear on who are your customers and what is your strategy there if you want to scale. I think another challenge for scale up is definitely talent acquisition. It's still quite difficult for startups to compete with larger companies in terms of attracting the right talents, in terms of package, benefits, titles. I think now startups are playing a lot the game of titles that you become quickly a VP or in the C-suite compared to being in a big multinational, which can be interesting. They work a lot on their purpose. And I see a lot of people making this shift now to work for startups compared to before, but I think it's still a big challenge also to retain the talents there. Probably people are not used to working also in such an ambiguous environment of a startup. So it requires also a lot of cultural mindset shift going there. I think scaling operations is also a very, very tough one while being on a growth path. How do you make sure that you manage this expansion while keeping the quality of the product, keeping your customers satisfied, having your operations be run in an effective and efficient way is very interesting. I think there are plenty of programs there, Sharon, and the real entrepreneurial one would go and look for them. For us, it's important when we look at the CEO to see how humble he is about what he knows and where he needs help. And this is actually a core criteria for Rising Food Stars. This year, I introduced the kind of leadership assessment in the founders, because if you want to move to become a scale up, you need to be ready to admit where you have your gaps and where you need support. And by doing so, I think naturally you're going to attract the right coaches, the right investors, the right people on board in your advisory board as well to support you in your journey. And there's so much available, be it from public funds, private funds, at the EU level, at the country level, regional level, to support the startup ecosystem, that you should be naive if you think that you can do it by yourself. And I think the results speak by themselves. By being part of this ecosystem, doesn't have to be an accelerator, but a network, because Rising Food Stars is actually a network, and it's equity free. So it's not about, just choosing the right place that makes sense for you. Usually it doubles your chances of succeeding. So yeah, that's my advice to the startups out there. If you had to surround yourself by the right people and be in programs where you can meet other founders, where you get connected to the right experts and the whole ecosystem.
Which is extremely important. So before you mentioned pilots, and obviously with EIT Food, you guys do a lot of corporate collaborations. How big a part do they play, and what are the challenges that you see the most, and where do you think we need to work more on collaboration in general?
It's one of my favorite themes, to be honest, Sharon, because me coming from the corporate world and now being on the other side, I feel like this is the biggest piece missing in the whole ecosystem, is how to bring this collaboration to reality, to, bring results as well, and see it come into life. We started at EIT Food, I think now 1 year, a little bit more than a year ago, to offer our corporate venturing services. And the idea was really to bring this collaboration with startups and corporate to life, educate the startups as well about how to work with corporates, and also educate corporates and prepare them for this collaboration, at least bring this awareness of what's going on from an innovation perspective. Bring them together in demo days, sometimes in pilots. Last year, I had an initiative in my program to financially support 5 companies that collaborated with corporates to bring to life a commercial pilot. And they received, as part of this initiative, also coaching on a specific aspect of go-to-market and commercialization. They received funding. And so it was a kind of full-fledged and preparation on how to work with corporates. I think that's something we see and might seem obvious. But when you come from the startup world, sometimes there is this barrier of so many layers, so many processes, takes time. So yeah, it requires a lot of preparation, but also from the corporate side, to educate them about agility, flexibility. How you get there through this collaboration. I think there are definitely so many benefits in this collaboration, and I'm not going to list them because they're quite obvious. I think for startups is mainly to have access to the knowledge of the corporate, to have access to their market distribution, et cetera. Funding, eventually, they have a lot of, you have now a lot of corporate venture arms. From the corporate side, I think it's quite natural. It's an access to, different mindset corporation. But I think it's quite challenging to get there. And the work has just been started a few years back, talking about all the open innovation and being really open and transparent about how adult innovation is still a challenge. If you think about it, for those corporates that have been building, decennies of knowledge and expertise, to suddenly want also to open up from their side if they want this collaboration to happen. I think there is an issue as well that I've seen in terms of mindset, and it can shift so quickly when you work with corporates. I also have seen in my experience, it depends a lot on the management. Then if there is a shift in management, sometimes you see that there is this hype and excitement about innovation, and then the resources are in lock, the budgets are in lock to focus on it. And then you might have another person that comes in that is more typical corporate leader and would be more focused on driving operation efficiencies, driving the core business, etc. Depends also on the macro economic level, what's going on in times of crisis, I think. Yeah, companies would tend to refocus on operations efficiencies rather than driving innovation. But I believe here, it's a matter of opening this communication and information flow between the two worlds and slowly facilitating this, which is the role that we're trying to play. For me, last year was quite fascinating, bringing some startups, for example, to food ingredients, to meet different corporates, have this informal conversation about what could be the potential commercial collaborations there, what's in it for both sides. And what we aim for at Rising Food Stars is also to bring those startups at kind of the same table, the same level as those corporates, to have a conversation about how they can work together and to empower the startups in this world, because it's very also difficult to navigate the corporate world in terms of who is the decision maker, who is the right person I should have access, what are they actually looking for, so I can know how to speak to them the right language and tailor my value proposition. And I have a workshop really specifically on that, is how to speak to a corporate and tailor your pitch, because there's so much going on about pitching to investors, but I think pitching to corporates is really important if you want to get your first clients or get your first pilots, and collaboration is really important to learn how to do that and be coached properly on that part.
I do agree. We also saw a shift, I think, in the past few years from just venturing and food tech and ag tech to the world of impact-driven startups, impact funds. But at least to me, one of the biggest challenges is that we don't have a unified way to measure things, measure impact. Every company sort of measures in their own way. There is so this is a little bit difficult to understand what impact means. What are your learnings and takeaways on this?
It's a very, very hot topic, actually. And we are moving as an organization also to what we call missions that are more around driving a greater sense of impact and value and getting closer to meet the SDGs or climate pledges. So we have these three missions about net zero, healthier lifestyle, and fair and resilient supply chain. But for me, particularly was interesting, and I have been collaborating recently with our strategic department and the impact team to see how we can bring this to life and to reality with starting with the scale up, because I think they are closer to the market somehow and to the reality. And you're absolutely right. So I think the first observation is that what does impact mean, and have this unified and common ground of what are we talking about. And impact can mean so many things for different companies, depending which areas. And we operate in so many areas and so many steps of the value chain that it's quantifiable differently. And what matters at a certain point is different. But I think that the challenge is indeed how to move from this theory into something more practical, but also to look at impact in different aspects. Because if we want to be honest to ourselves, we cannot be only about net zero, but ignore other aspects like biodiversity or social justice. These are diversity as well in the workspace. If you are a startup that is doing great on net zero, but not doing well in terms of the diversity, are you really an impactful company? So I think having this holistic approach is also important. But we have been running actually some interviews recently with the scale up to understand what are their takes on impact and the barriers they are facing. And what they have been telling us recently is that one of the biggest challenges they face is how to balance between short-term results and the milestones that they have to achieve with their investors, and also the long-term systemic change that they want to bring to the world that requires time, and that requires also to have the right partners that think alike, right? You need to have your suppliers that think the same way, your customers, your the right investors on board to help you on that. I think one of the questions that we always hear, as you mentioned, is how do I measure impact in a smart and efficient way, in a way that can be benchmarked to others as well? What are the guidelines there? How do we validate this data in a way that is not also timely and costly for the startup? I think some of them at the scale-up stage, they start having some kind of sustainability manager or really like a senior manager focused on this aspect, but they cannot all afford it. It's not only about that. It's also about keeping the business running. I think something that is quite interesting here is, and that we try to help them also with, is how to build this new narrative on business and innovation about impact. And I think that's the game changing part, because if you are as a startup able to really have this strong narrative backed up by facts, by data, and you are in a very, very powerful position. And speaking about differentiation, as I said at the beginning, this could be a really big differentiator versus other companies out there to stand out in front of investors and incorporate. And actually, the companies that have really a sense of impact in terms of mission and that comes to life in their business model, etc., have times more chances of scaling up and being successful. It's quite fascinating that it has a link to the business. It's not only about the greenwashing or having a beautiful mission, inspiring. And I think now investors and corporates are looking at it more from a deep dive to understand, do you really have it in your DNA and you're doing your best to bring it to life in your operations, in your relationship with your suppliers, with your employees as well? That's also an important part. So I think that's an exciting piece of work. We're going to have a big workshop in June with the Rising Stars members for us continue learning from their perspective, as they are the ones on the ground, but also to bring in a lot of the experts in this area and see how we can give them some mentoring on how to bring their own narratives to life, their own ways, and in the most differentiated way possible.
Yep, the power of storytelling. So, I mean, obviously you have seen several cohorts. You keep your eye out. What are some of the trends, the hottest trends that you see happening for this year and the next?
Well, when it comes to scale ups, because we are at a little bit later stage, sometimes it's not, you know, between being the most innovative and reaching this stage of scaling up is like 3 to 5 years for the best ones. But I think the trends are pretty common, at least the trends that or the technologies that we want to keep hearing about, and we see that the ecosystem is still excited about being clearer and clearer for us from the conversations we have. What we continue finding interesting is the whole farm management, so anything related to data, precision farming, the software, so the support decision-making for farmers are quite an exciting area. I think here we are really reaching a stage where we want to see more scale-ups coming out of this place, because that's the challenge. There is a challenge about cost and about gathering as much data as possible, because that's what makes you powerful as a startup and what makes you stand out. We have an interesting startup in this area within the Rising Food Stars called Farm 21 from Netherlands. They are on a good track to scale up, hopefully beyond Europe as well. I think continuing on ag tech, anything related to biotech is quite interesting here. So we want to see more solutions in this area in terms of processes, technologies. We have quite a few as well in the Rising Food Stars, such as trying to crack the genetics somehow and come up with solutions that are less harmful. Something that we have been hearing a lot about is the regenerative agriculture as well. It continues to be a good topic. And one specifically interesting area in this part is the carbon sequestration and all the topics related to carbon credits. Again, here we have a very interesting company called Soil Capital that are doing a great job in this area. We've seen a lot of investment also going in this field. There is also the part related to sustainable aquaculture. I think it's quite challenging, this part, right? Because it's there's so much that still need to happen in terms of data management, in terms of finding also. I think we see a lot of overlap here with alternative seafoods and proteins, such as betta fish, and also solutions to track better what's happening out there in the fishing industry and gather data so things are optimized better. I think on the food tech area, yeah, as you mentioned, there is a little bit of slowdown here and lower interest in terms of the ingredients that are not novel anymore. Let's say the peas, the chickpeas, the soya, there's a way less hype around them. But what we've seen interesting is all the ingredients that are more like replacing additives or adding functionality to alternative protein to either have a better texture, better taste, clean labels. I think fat alternatives as well are quite a big area. We had a company called Cubic Foods as well operating in this space. In terms of functional ingredients, I think we have seen a lot around sugar replacement. Egg replacement as well is quite an exciting one, especially if you talk about bakeries as well and all the topics related to that. And this year, I saw quite an interesting new area about shelf life extension. So many solutions come in there, be it about bio-coating or about how to preserve, like, for example, having fresh foods in a drinkable water. And being able to have it for a few months. So there are some interesting technologies coming on that area. And I would say anything related to circularity, Sharon. I mean, we love circularity. I think we're just scratching the surface here. There's so much waste going on. I mean, the common data is 1/3 of the food is wasted. So there's so much we can do with this 1/3. But what is interesting is that there is now more companies in the space of upcycling than preventing. So all the recycling piece, we have companies that are recycling the spent grains from the brewery industries like Agrain, or some that are using bits of plums or how you call it, cherries as well, like Gerntech, in different types of oils or spreads or milks. And I think there's so much that can be done here with coffee waste as well. And we've seen a lot going on, different type of flowers that we are just discovering. It's really a beautiful space that I see a lot of excitement from different people in the food industry.
It is a beautiful space, isn't it? We talked about a lot of stuff and you mentioned some challenges, possible solutions. Obviously, they are not immediate. They're not going to happen tomorrow. But if you could have one thing happen tomorrow, what would it be?
Well, it's a tough question because we're talking about big space, right? And have a magic wand. Yeah, a magic wand. To achieve net zero, to support better lifestyle, improve our supply chain. I think in my opinion, it starts with believing in it again. I have the impression that a lot of people gave up and think that, yeah, we are in the wrong place and that the next generation is already in a bad position and there is not much we can do about it. I think, you know, bringing again this faith and belief in people that we can still achieve it and we can contribute individually at our level, but also collectively with our small ecosystem, bigger ecosystem, no matter in which position we are, right? We need to keep this in mind and believe in it and action it as much as possible in our daily life, in our professional lives. On a day in, day out. And I think that's the role also of the whole public engagement to really make sure that we give hope that there are still things that we can change and, that's how we will start acting because we need to believe first.
I completely agree. We really cannot let the next generation just handle all this mess that we did. I am so sorry. We are out of time, but please tell us what's cooking with you. What's next? What are you planning? And when is the next cohort coming out?
So we have the cohort of 2023 just announced now, end of May. So we'll have around 13 new companies joining Rising Food Stars. So in total, around 35, because it's a 3 years program. So we have companies staying from the past year. We're going to meet them all end of June in our kickoff event. So after COVID, I think we really believe in the sense of connections and bringing people together and founders together to discuss, but also to get them to see the whole community of our partners. I'm super excited about workshop that we are running on impact, the one I told you about, where it's the first time that we're doing something really specific for scale ups, and I'm personally excited to see how we can bring it in a holistic but also pragmatic and measurable way. Otherwise there are a lot of exciting events happening. I think between June and December, we have the Future Food Tech London, we have the Food Ingredients and Anuga this year. So it's always a great source of inspiration, meeting all the new connections. I think being in the ecosystem will start to build in beyond connections, actually friendships and people that are like-minded, that share the same values. So that's really the exciting part of being in this community and doing this job.
I couldn't agree with you more. So thank you very, very much. And thank you for the work you're doing.
Thank you, Sharon. Thanks for having me. It was a great pleasure exchanging with you.
Want to dive deep into food innovation? Subscribe to the Food Tech Junkie series. Tune in and listen to the industry's champions whose mission is to reinvent our future by collaborating and disrupting the status quo as a way to rebalance our planet in our daily lives. For more great content, visit our website at www.edibleplanetventures.com and follow us on social media on the Edible Planet Ventures channels.